as well played, Mr. Haskell. The only hit for the band, Europe. Where our friend Bruce Pratt has been these last several weeks, but he's back with us.
Yeah.
Home again and filled with oodles of stories.
Yeah, a lot of interesting sports stuff. We tend to think of Europe from this side of the pond. Okay, soccer we know is big, right?
I've heard that.
We know that hockey is big in Europe, and certainly it's huge in certain countries. Slovakia, boy, mention you know anything about hockey, and they love it. But you forget how big sports like skiing and the like are, and you forget that they also watch a lot of American sports. I ran into a lot of people who love the NFL.
Hmm.
In fact, we ran into a waiter in Bratislava at this great restaurant we ate in Bratislava a couple nights, and he asked us where we're from. I told him Maine, and it's nice. I love the New England Patriots.
Hmm.
I like the Boston Bruins. I like the New York Yankees. And he was going through the teams he liked. Yeah. But I said, you know, how did you become interested in the NFL? And he said, well, they show it. He said, and because it's on TV, we watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you forget the reach. I mean, Travis Vogan talked about this a couple of times with us when we talked about ESPN. It is a worldwide reach now. And games that you wouldn't expect to see. I mean, they were sure they're showing all the World Cup soccer, but there were times when people told me, oh, yeah, last night I watched the Major League Game of the Week broadcast in Germany.
Huh.
So you maybe you get Germany because they're American air bases and stuff there, but I was surprised by how much they know about American sports other than the individual sports.
By the way, quick update on the Women's World Cup, the semifinal, still scoreless in the 74th minute with Sweden and the Netherlands.
Wow. Yeah, they do love their soccer over there. I was thinking about Stack. He would have absolutely been in heaven. We were in Dortmund, Germany, and our friend Sylvester's took us to the stadium there, which is the largest soccer stadium in Europe, and it's the famous standing yellow wall where 15 or 20,000 people stand, and they can drink all they want, and they're there before the game and they're there after the game. I don't know how they do it, but an incredible operation, and people are so soccer crazy for that Dortmund Borussia team in Switzerland that wealthy Swiss people buy flats, as they call them, small apartments in Dortmund for the 18 times a year that Dortmund plays at home. And I got to tell you, as you know, I'm not a big soccer fan on any level, though I did buy a soccer ball and two soccer nets for my grandchildren. But the astonishing way if we ran our football stadiums the way they run their football stadiums, and I mean our American football stadiums, the season ticket holders everybody would buy a season ticket. I mean, it's just the food that gets put out and everything. The sense that this is an important event when it happens, not a big event. And I think there's a difference.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You know, it's not they don't have tailgating. Right? You go to the game and you go early and you can get all the food and drink you want. And at halftime, you can get more. But it's about being there the whole time, wearing the all yellow. You know, they combine sort of the best of the college kind of, you know, Cameron crazies or something like that, or the maniacs at the Alphon. But yeah, that was really pretty interesting, a place to visit. And that was really the only sports site that we visited, except seeing as we took the slow Bernina Express all the way up from the south of Switzerland to the north through the Alps. Did see some, you could see the ski lifts in a couple of places, and there was still plenty of snow if you wanted to go skiing up high. But that was a pretty spectacular part of it. But went to Sports Lit.
Yeah.
And 36th annual conference. Next one's in St. Louis. Our good friend Scott Peterson and I are he's the host and I'm the program chair. We saw something remarkable. The Olympics in 2024 are in Paris, the Summer Games. And the French decided that they wanted the entire country to be involved, that they didn't want it just to be about elite athletes and rich people who could get tickets. So every French school child, let me explain this again. Every French school child in public schools, from kindergarten through the 12th grade, in every class is involved in something for the Olympics. Some of these classes have been kids picking a sport and writing poems in another language.
Wow.
To be put into a book, to be part of the permanent collection of this. And they are expecting that the people who will participate on an active basis will be in the tens of millions of people. And they're going to have a display. And here's the reason why. When de Coubertin revived the Olympics, people forget that literature and other art forms were part of those first revived Olympics. And France thought that since de Coubertin was French and since those Olympics were in Paris, it might be a good idea to sort of bring that idea back, you know, which is better than, I think, at least than synchronized swimming or bouldering. But they're trying to focus more on it being an event on the world stage that is also a cultural event, not just an athletic event. And they feel, the French feel that the Olympic movement's gotten away from that. And, you know, I certainly think there's a lot to be said for that. And they are minimizing corporate involvement. And the government itself is going to do much more of the legwork and the brick and mortar work to do the Olympics. So they're not beholden to Coca-Cola or Peugeot or whomever. And that was a really interesting, I think all of us were pretty surprised by that. But saw some great stuff. There's a guy we've got to get on the show who I met actually on the train between Paris and Limoges. I didn't know him. His name is Rob Sheinkopf. Rob Sheinkopf was for years a college admissions officer. Almost became one at Maine until he realized he was going to make a third of what he was making somewhere else when they offered him the job. But his presentation was my year in the big leagues, and I thought maybe when he was young he'd been a ball player. But no. He retired and his wife got tired of him doing nothing, so she bought him a dog. And he, you know, that was a couple of times a day he got out of the house. And finally she said, you got to do something. So he saw an ad for ushers and premium seating concierge and for the Giants. And he lives in walking distance of the park. So he thought, he filled out an application. Somebody called him up and he talked to him. And he got a job. But he didn't get a job as an usher. He got a job as the concierge. For instance, one of the boxes he takes care of is Willie Mays' private box.
Oh, wow.
So he's had all this time with Willie Mays. All these great ball players he'd met, these wonderful experiences. But what was great were the stories that we don't hear. You know, the kinds of things that people like the owners of this station do. Quietly, don't tell anybody, make a big difference in someone's life. The stories of you know, kids who idolize a certain ball player and were too poor or too ill or whatever to go to a ball game, end up sitting in the box. Well, this guy's job, Rob's job, involves basically being the guy who makes sure that nobody walks into these boxes unwanted or unwelcomed or whatever. He told so many great stories, and the slideshow he did with it was phenomenal, which obviously we couldn't reproduce on radio, but he's funny. He's like, he's Ryan Wayning funny. He's real quick, you know, very, very quick. And he's going to go back and do it for another year. And I thought about all the job, you know, you hear some people say, well, I'd like to do something to stay active. He's not making a lot of money doing this. He gets paid. And he says, you know, this is better than being a greeter at Walmart. I guess they don't even have those anymore. But you think about, for so many people, when they retire means they retire from society. And it was just a great, great, really, really fun presentation. And then I learned about a road race I never know called the Imogene Parr Long Distance Pass Run. That takes place in Colorado. It's at altitude. It's a long race. That part's not really important for this. But Miles Schrag, who was the son of Joel Schrag, who wrote the Kansas Relays book that we talked about, Miles lives in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he's a runner. And people from Flagstaff make this a community project to do this run. And hundreds of Flagstaff runners train for this race in Colorado. And I believe somebody from Flagstaff's won virtually every single one of them. And he was talking about how it has spawned writing. They're publishing a book about everybody's memories of this, and how that this running community has united a large portion of Flagstaff in a way that, because they don't have a professional sports team. They don't. They haven't used, you know, Northern Arizona University, but they don't have a horseshoe or a, you know, a giant stadium to sort of unite people that running has done it, which was very cool. But the one I really wanted to, I want to talk about two really interesting presentations. One by Tristan Ireson-Howes is from Canterbury Christ Church University in England, about comparing Beckett's Waiting for Godot to DeLillo's In the End Zone.
Mm.
And the I thought, oh, how's that? And when it was done, you know, 20 minutes later, I was sitting in my chair going, man, there's some smart people in this world to figure these things out. That the structure of End Zone is almost exactly the same as Waiting for Godot. DeLillo's admitted to being a Beckett fan and some other stuff. One other great presentation, and unfortunately the book is a ways off and he doesn't want to talk about it till the book's out, but friend of the show, Dennis Gilday, who we've had on, he wrote about the death of the National Sports Daily and Hoops Crazy, the book on Clear B. Dennis did a presentation called Boxing and the Scopes Monkey Trial.
Hmm.
I took a look at that title and I said, what could be going on here? Well, it turns out, the focus was on a guy named McGeehan, who was a writer, both a sports journalist and a journalist in New York City, who wrote extensively on boxing and then was sent to cover the Scopes trial. And some of the great language that he used, comparing Darrow and William Jennings Bryan, he took right from boxing terminology. Mm. And Dennis read some different chapters, different parts of the chapter that he's writing about this and comparing it. And you know, you sort of remembered when sports writing was great. You know, I mean, it was, I was saying to someone, it reminded me of W.C. Hinds' great Death of a Racehorse. All the terminology was there, but it wasn't that bombastic terminology. It was,
right.
You know, the counterpunch, it was a staggering blow. He retreated to the corner, that kind of thing, but used with an elegant language that the best kind of journalism would use. And I had never heard of McGeehan, and I'm going to forget his first name, even though Dennis sent me an email with it today. But it was the kind of thing that you know, it's why I always tell people that if they think they're at all interested, they should join SLA, because all of the presentations that I saw, and I saw every single one, we're like that. And another great thing we will be getting soon, Terry Sawchuk, Poems to Hockey Movie, Randy Maggs, Night Work, the Sawchuk Poems, which we've talked about and we've had Randy on, was interviewed by another friend of the show, Angie Abdu, about the movie that Randy's daughters have made that will be out soon in Canada. I think it'll be a Netflix release in the U.S. I don't remember the details. I took a lot of notes trying to keep stuff in my head. But we'll get a drop on that really early, and it's already from people that have seen the rough cuts and stuff, said to be just maybe one of the great hockey movies of all time. I mean, it's a biography of Sawchuk based on that book-length series of poems that Randy wrote. And he's got a new one coming out on the year 1968 in Vietnam. So I said 1968, that's right up downtown's alley.
Oh, yeah.
We had a few specials on that, so. It was good. It was a great conference. There was a lot more I could talk about, but we're running out of time.
Yeah, well, what's our next book that we'll talk about in a couple of weeks?
I'm not sure, because the book I wanted to talk about arrived, but the book jacket and the dust cover and the cover were the right book, but the inside was the wrong book.
Oh.
And that was on sort of the way fans seem to privilege themselves as being part of the game, by a guy named Noah Cohen. If I get that book in time to read it for next week, it'll be that. And if not, I'm not sure.
All right.
But I'll have one.